me. He had saved my life. I thought him a good man then, as I do today. I feared he had made a mistake, but I couldn't stand in judgment of him. I thought too well of him and owed him too much to stand between him and his freedom. I wished him well as he departed, carrying a letter from me to Carol in his pocket. Bud and I remained roommates for about another month. When the Vietnamese observed that I could get around on my crutches, they moved Bud to another cell. In April 1968, Bud was relocated to another prison, and I was moved into another building, the largest cell block in the camp, the warehouse. I cannot adequately describe how sorry I was to part company with my friend and inspiration. Up until then, I don't believe I had ever relied on any other person for emotional and physical support to the extent I had relied on Bud. Although I could manage to hobble around on my crutches, I was still in poor shape. My arms had not yet healed, and I couldn't pick up or carry anything. I was still suffering from dysentery, a chronic ailment throughout most of my years in prison, and I weighed little more than 100 pounds. Bud, whose injuries were nearly as debilitating as mine, helped me enormously by building my confidence in my eventual recovery. He joked about our condition and got me to laugh about it as well. Bud was taken to a prison, the zoo, where the conditions and the cruelty of camp authorities made the plantation seem like a resort. He would suffer terribly there, confronting the full force of man's inhumanity to man. I was distraught when he left, but better prepared to endure my fate, thanks to the months of his unflagging encouragement. I bid goodbye to him warmly, trying not to betray the sadness I felt to see him go. I would remain in solitary confinement for over 2 years. It's an awful thing, solitary. It crushes your spirit and weakens your resistance more effectively than any other form of mistreatment. The first few weeks are the hardest. The onset of despair is immediate, and it is a formidable foe. I tried to memorize the names of POWs, the names and personal details of guards and interrogators. I devised other memory games to keep my faculties sound. For days, I tried to remember the names of all the pilots in my squadron and our sister squadron. I also prayed more often and more fervently than I ever had as a free man. Many prisoners spent their hours exercising their minds by concentrating on an academic discipline or hobby they were proficient in. I tried to compose books and plays of my own, often acting out sequences in the quiet solitude of my cell. I had to carefully guard against my fantasies becoming so consuming that they took me permanently to a place in my mind from which I might fail to return. On several occasions, I became terribly annoyed when a guard entered my cell to take me to the bath or to bring me food and disrupted some flight of fantasy where the imagined comforts were so attractive that I could not easily bear to be deprived of them. Sadly, I knew of a few men in prison who had grown so content in their imaginary worlds that they preferred solitary confinement and turned down the offer of a roommate. Eventually, they stopped communicating with the rest of us. For long stretches of every day, I would watch the activities in camp through a crack in my door, grateful to witness any unusual or amusing moment that broke the usual monotony of prison administration. As I began to settle into my routine, I came to appreciate the POW adage, "The days and hours are very long, but the weeks and months pass quickly." Solitary also put me in a pretty surly mood, and I would resist depression by hollering insults at my guards, resorting to the belligerence that I had relied on earlier in my life when obliged to suffer one indignity or another. Resisting, being uncooperative, and a general pain in the ass proved, as it had in the past, to be a morale booster for me. Hypochondria is a malady that commonly afflicts prisoners held in solitary confinement. A man becomes extremely conscious of his physical condition and can worry excessively over every ailment that plagues him. After Bud and I were separated, I struggled to resist concern bordering on paranoia that my injuries and poor health would eventually prove mortal. I received nothing in the way of medical treatment. 3 or 4 times a year, Zorba, the prison medic, would drop by for a brief visit. After a quick visual appraisal of my condition, he would leave with an exhortation to eat more and exercise. That I often could not keep down the little food allowed me after the guards had taken their share did not strike Zorba as paradoxical. Nor did Zorba bother to explain how I might manage to exercise, given my disabling injuries and the narrow confines of my cell. By late summer in 1969, my dysentery had eased. The strength I gained from holding down my food enabled me to begin exercising my leg. Whenever possible, I limped around my cell. My arms were another matter. Over a period of 2 years, I began to regain some use of them, but even then, exercise occasionally resulted in my arms' total immobility for a period that could last up to a month. In the last 2 years of my captivity, prisoners were quartered together in large cells. Because of the improvement in our food and living conditions, I was strong enough to perform a rigorous daily exercise routine. There is little doubt that solitary confinement causes some mental deterioration in even the most resilient personalities. When in 1970, my period of solitary confinement was finally ended, I was overwhelmed by the compulsion to talk nonstop, face to face, with my obliging new cellmate. I ran my mouth ceaselessly for 4 days. My cellmate, John Finley, who had once been held in solitary himself and understood my exuberant reaction to his company, listened intently, frequently nodding his head in assent to my rhetorical points, even though he could not possibly have taken in more than a fraction of my rambling dialogue. I have observed this phenomenon in many other men when they were released from solitary. One of the more amusing spectacles in prison is the sight of two men, both just released from solitary, talking their heads off simultaneously, neither one listening to the other, both absolutely enraptured by the sound of their voices. Most solos settled down after spending a few days with a roommate and recovered the strength and confidence of men who were sound in both mind and body. We had a saying in prison, steady strain. The point of the remark was to remind us to keep a close watch on our emotions, not to let them rise and fall with circumstances that were out of our control. We tried hard to avoid seizing on any small change in our treatment as an indication of an approaching change in our fortunes. We called some POWs gastropoliticians because their spirits soared every time they found a carrot in their soup. "Look at this, they're fattening us up," they would declare. "We must be going home." And when no omen appeared in the next day's meal, the gastropolitician's irrational exuberance of the previous day would disappear, and he would sink into an equally irrational despondency, lamenting, "We're never getting out of here." Most of the prisoners considered it unhealthy to allow themselves to interpret our circumstances like tea leaf readers divining some secret purpose in the most unremarkable event. Prison was enough of a psychological strain without riding an emotional roller coaster of our own creation. When you're left alone with your thoughts for years, it's hard not to reflect on how better you could have spent your time as a free man. I had more than a normal share of regrets, but regret for choosing the career that had landed me in this place was not among them. I regretted I hadn't read more books so I could keep my mind better occupied in solitary. I regretted much of the foolishness that had characterized my youth. I regretted I hadn't worked harder at the academy, believing that I might have been better prepared for the trial I now faced. Of all the activities I devised to survive solitary confinement, with my wits and strength intact, nothing was more beneficial than communicating with other prisoners. It was simply a matter of life and death. Fortunately, the Vietnamese, although they went to extraordinary lengths to prevent it, couldn't stop all communication among prisoners. Through flashed hand signals when we were moved about, tap codes on the wall, notes hidden in washroom drains, and holding our enamel drinking cups up to the wall with our shirts wrapped around them and speaking through them, we were able to communicate with each other. The whole prison system became a complex information network. The tap code was a simple device. The signal to communicate was the old rhythm, shave and a haircut, and the response, 2 bits, was given if the coast was clear. We divided the alphabet into 5 columns of 5 letters each. The letter K was dropped. A, F, L, Q, and V were the key letters. Tap once for the 5 letters in the A column, twice for F, 3 times for L, and so on. After indicating the column, pause for a beat, then tap 1 through 5 times to indicate the right letter. McCain would be tapped, 3213132433. It was an easy system to teach the uninitiated, and new guys would usually be communicating like veterans within a few days. The punishment for communicating could be severe, and a few POWs, having been caught and beaten for their efforts, had their spirits broken as their bodies were battered. Terrified of a return trip to the punishment room, they would lie still in their cells when their comrades tried to tap them up on the wall. Very few would remain uncommunicative for long. To suffer all this alone was less tolerable than torture. Almost all would recover their strength in a few days and answer the summons to rejoin the living. In October 1968, I heard the guards bring a new prisoner into the camp and lock him into the cell behind mine. Ernie Brace was a decorated former Marine who had flown over 100 combat missions in the Korean War. He had been accused of deserting the scene of an aircraft accident, court-martialed, and discharged dishonorably from the service. Determined to restore his good name, he had volunteered as a civilian pilot to fly supply missions in Laos for the United States Agency for International Development, and, when asked, to secretly supply CIA-supported military units in the Laotian jungle. During one such operation, communist insurgents, the Pathet Lao, overran the small airstrip where he had just landed and captured him. His captors handed him over to soldiers in the North Vietnamese Army, who marched him to a remote outpost near Dien Bien Phu. He was imprisoned for 3 years in a bamboo cage with his arms and legs bound. He attempted 3 escapes. He was brutally tortured, held in leg stocks, and tethered to a stake by a rope around his neck. After his last failed escape attempt, the Vietnamese buried him in a pit up to his neck and left him there for a week. In 1968, he was brought to Hanoi. When the commotion in the cell behind me died down as the guards left Ernie alone in his new home, I tried to tap him up on the wall. In terrible shape, and fearful that the knocks he heard in the cell next door were made by Vietnamese trying to entrap him in an attempted violation of the prohibition against communicating, he made no response. For days, I tried in vain to talk to him. Finally, he tapped back, a faint but audible 2 bits. I put my drinking cup to the wall and spoke directly to my new neighbor. Do you have a drinking cup? No response. Tap twice if you have a drinking cup and once if you don't. No response. I continued at some length, vainly trying to get him to talk to me. But as he had just been given a drinking cup, his suspicion that he was being set up by the Vietnamese intensified as I urged him to make illicit use of it. A few days later, the possibility that he could talk with another American for the first time in 3 years overrode his understandable caution. I'm Lieutenant Commander John McCain. I was shot down over Hanoi in 1967. Who are you? My name is Ernie Brace, came the response. Are you Air Force, Navy, Marine? My name is Ernie Brace. Where were you shot down? My name is Ernie Brace. To my every query, Ernie could only manage to say his name before he broke down. I could hear him crying. It took some time before Ernie could keep his composure long enough to engage in informative conversation. But once he did, he became a tireless talker. As a civilian, Ernie was under no obligation to adhere to the code of conduct. The United States expected him not to betray any highly sensitive information, the disclosure of which would endanger the lives of other Americans. But other than that, he was not required to show any fidelity to his country and her cause beyond the demands of his own conscience. But Ernie's conscience demanded much from him. He kept our code faithfully. When the Vietnamese offered to release him, he declined, insisting that others captured before him be released first. It was an honor to serve with him. There were about 80 Americans held at the plantation during my first years in prison. Eventually, I would come to know many of the men at the plantation. Keeping an ever-lengthening account of the men we learned were prisoners was a solemn responsibility of every POW. We would fall asleep at night while silently chanting the names on the list. Knowing the men in my prison and being known by them was my best assurance of returning home. Communicating not only affirmed our humanity, it kept us alive. The walls of the plantation enclosed what had once been a lovely estate. Numerous trees were all that remained of the gardens, but the large mansion that had formerly housed Hanoi's mayor when Vietnam was a French colony still stood in reasonably good repair. We called it the Big House, and we were taken there for initial interrogation. It also provided receiving rooms for American peace delegations. Several warehouses surrounded the mansion. They were divided into cells and housed the POW population. After Bud Day and I were separated, I was kept alone in room 13 West at the south end of the warehouse. The cells in the plantation were large compared to those at other prisons. Mine was approximately 15 by 15 feet. Each cell had a wooden board for a bed and a naked light bulb dangling on a cord in the center of the ceiling. The light was kept on 24 hours a day. I got used to it after a while. It didn't bother me much in the winter, but in the summer heat, the extra warmth from the light made our discomfort all the harder to bear. The cell windows were boarded up to prevent us from seeing out and from communicating with one another, blocking all ventilation except for some small holes near the top of the wall. The daily routine was simple and excruciatingly dull. The guard struck a gong at 6 in the morning, signaling the start of a new day. We rose, folded our gear, and listened from the loudspeakers in our cells to Hanoi Hannah, the voice of Vietnam, a half hour of witless propaganda rebroadcast from the night before. For most POWs, Hannah was a pretty good source of entertainment. "American GIs, don't fight in this illegal and immoral war," Hannah pleaded, before reporting the latest victories of the heroic People's Liberation Forces. She brought us news from home, which was, of course, limited to updates on anti-war activities and incidents of civil strife. About an hour after Hannah's morning rebroadcast, the turnkeys opened each cell door, and one at a time, each prisoner brought his waste bucket out, set it down, and stepped back into his cell. After all the waste buckets were placed outside and the guards had locked the prisoners back in their cells, two POWs were assigned the task of collecting the buckets, dumping their contents into a large hole in the back of the camp, washing them out, and returning them to their owners. For a brief while, the prisoners used this daily chore to pass notes on cigarette paper and other scraps of paper. The Vietnamese soon discovered our treachery and kept a closer eye on the unfortunate POWs who drew this duty. After the buckets were returned, the guards filled our teapots. If it was a wash day, they would then take us to bathe. In winters, when water was plentiful, we would often bathe twice a week. In summer, when water was scarce, we would sometimes go weeks without bathing. After we had hung our wet clothes and wash rag out to dry and returned to our cells, each prisoner was taken back out, one at a time, to pick up his breakfast, usually a piece of bread and a bowl of soup made by boiling something that vaguely resembled a pumpkin. Each prisoner was then returned to a cell and locked in before the next prisoner was allowed to collect his morning meal. The food at the plantation was notoriously bad. The pots in which our meals were prepared were never washed, and the guards who served us were only slightly cleaner, and I cringed whenever I watched our food being prepared. After we finished eating, the process was repeated in reverse as we returned our empty bowls. There were no other activities after breakfast until we were brought out for the afternoon meal. On wash days, we collected our dry clothes with the afternoon meal. Shortly after lunch, around noon, they rang the gong again to signal the afternoon nap, which lasted until 2. Until the gong sounded, we weren't allowed to lie down unless we were ill. On some afternoons, they piped in additional propaganda broadcasts. Our boredom was periodically alleviated by the provision of reading materials. Most often, I was given a copy of the Vietnam Courier, a propaganda rag. Other times, I received awkwardly written books boasting of extraordinary Vietnamese war victories. We were also read aloud to quite often, works by prominent American authors who were opposed to the war. Sometimes we were made to watch movies in which Vietnamese nationalism was accorded even greater supernatural powers than it was in books and newspapers. A tank division or several American battalions were never a match for one lightly armed, gallant, kind to women and children, Vietnamese fighting man. Although I suppose I should have been insulted by such heavy-handed propaganda, it was so clumsy and so absurd that it seldom failed to amuse me. We were deprived of even the most basic comforts. It would be too time-consuming a task to list all the things I missed in prison. I miss the staples of life, of course. Good and plentiful food, a comfortable bed, being out of doors. But the thing I missed most was information. Free, uncensored, undistorted, abundant information. At 9 o'clock every evening, the guards rang the evening gong, instructing us to go to sleep, and, shivering in the cold or sweating in the stifling heat, beset by mosquitoes, and in the glare of a naked light bulb, we tried to escape to our dreams. That was our day. The only thing that changed my daily regimen was an interrogation. Interrogations were irregular events. 3 or 4 weeks could pass before I was subjected to one. Other times, I was interrogated twice in one day, sometimes by senior officers, sometimes by lower-ranking officers or enlisted personnel, whom we called quiz kids. The sound of jangling keys and fumbling with locks at night or at other irregular times had the effect of unexpected gunfire. I shot bolt upright the moment I heard it, gripped by terror, my heart beating so loud I thought it would be audible to the approaching guard. In the years after I came home, I never suffered from flashbacks or post-traumatic stress syndrome, as it is clinically termed. But for a long time after coming home, I would tense up whenever I heard keys rattle. They never interrogated or tortured us in our cells. They always took us to interrogation rooms, Spartan cells with bare walls, furnished with just a wooden table, a chair behind the table, and a stool in front of it, lower than the chair for the prisoner to sit on. Some interrogations were comparatively benign. Sometimes they were little more than training sessions for a new interrogator who was trying to learn English. The interrogators would demand information or order me to confess my crimes into a tape recorder. When I refused, they would make a perfunctory threat to persuade me to reconsider. When I refused again, they just sent me back to my cell. On other occasions, the interrogators were deadly serious, and if they threatened to beat you into cooperation, you were certain they would give it a hell of a try. Often, we knew how difficult things were likely to become by the identity of the interrogator. We called one interrogator the soft soap fairy for his delicate manners and the solicitous good cop routine he employed in well-spoken English to plead with prisoners for their cooperation. "How are you, Mac Cain?" he would greet me. If another interrogator, who lacked soft soap's gentility, had recently roughed me up, he would tell me how sorry he was. "This terrible war," he would say, "I hope it's over soon." "Me too," I would reply. Soft Soap was a political officer, and theoretically he had authority at least commensurate with the camp commanders. But he was never around for the less pleasant aspects of an interrogator's work. He never threatened to torture us, but it would advise us that our lack of cooperation was likely to incur the camp commander's displeasure, and warn us that the commander could be a harsh and unforgiving man. Whenever we personally experienced just how harsh and unforgiving, Soft Soap always claimed that he had been away from the camp at the time and unable to prevent our punishment from getting out of hand. "I'm sorry, Mac Cain, I was not here. The camp commander sometimes cannot control himself." "No problem." Regrettably, I didn't always draw Soft Soap as my interrogator. In the later years of my captivity, I sometimes sat on the stool looking into the cockeyed stare of the bug. If I refused Bug's demands or gave him any lip, he would order the guards to knock me around until I at least stopped trading insults with him. The bug was a sadist. On occasions, when he was particularly determined, I would find myself trussed up and left for hours in ropes, my biceps bound tightly with several loops to cut off my circulation, and the end of the rope cinched behind my back, pulling my shoulders and elbows unnaturally close together. It was incredibly painful. However, even during these difficult encounters, I realized my captors were more careful not to permanently injure or disfigure me than they were with other prisoners. When they tied me in the ropes, they rolled my sleeves up so that my shirt served as padding between my arms and the ropes, a courtesy they seldom granted their other victims. The Vietnamese also never put me in ankle stocks or leg irons, a punishment they inflicted on many POWs. With the exception of a rough time I would experience in the summer of 1968, and a few other occasions when a guard or interrogator acted impulsively out of anger, I always sensed that they refrained from doing their worst to me. The realization that my captors accorded me different treatment than the other prisoners made me bolder and at times more reckless than I should have been. It also made me feel guilty to know that my courage and loyalty had not been put to the test with the same cruelty and tenacity that marked our captors' attempts to destroy the resolve of other prisoners. We could always tell when new orders had arrived and things were about to take a turn for the worse. Prisoners would start disappearing from their cells, some for hours, others for days. When they returned to their cells, they would start tapping, telling us they had been tortured, how bad it was, and what the Vietnamese were after. The rest of us sat in our cells, sometimes listening to the screams of a tortured friend fill the air, sweating out the hours until the guards came for us. They never seemed to mind hurting us, but they usually took care not to let things get so out of hand that our lives were put in danger. We strongly believe some POWs were tortured to death, but the Vietnamese prized us as bargaining chips in peace negotiations, and, with tragic exceptions, they usually did not intend to kill us when they used torture to force our cooperation. In my case, I felt pretty certain that no matter how rough my periodic visits to the interrogation room were, my father's rank gave me value as a potential propaganda opportunity and as a proffer in peace negotiations, and thus restrained my captors from killing me. Authority was apportioned among four categories of prison authorities. The senior officers and interrogators occupied the top of the pecking order. The camp commander, a regular army officer, was nominally in charge of the prison. The relationship between camp commander and political officer varied somewhat from camp to camp. At the plantation, Soft Soap Ferry was the political officer, and he always referred to Slopehead, the camp commander, as the officer responsible for torture and punishment. Next in line were the turnkeys, who supervised our daily routine. They let us out of our cells to collect our meals and to bathe, locked us back in when we had finished. The turnkeys were younger than the interrogators. Many of them were still in their teens. For a time, I had a turnkey who ritualistically expressed his intense dislike of me. We called him the prick. He would enter my cell and order me to bow. Our captors believed that their advantage over us entitled them to formal displays of deference. They expected us to bow whenever they approached us. We believed otherwise. When the prick ordered me to bow, I would refuse, and he would respond to the discourtesy by smashing his fist into the side of my head and knocking me down. On a few occasions, when I just didn't feel up to the confrontation and bowed, he hit me anyway. Occupying the last station in the camp hierarchy were the Vietnamese we called gun guards. They were young soldiers who wandered around the camp carrying a rifle on their shoulder. Most gun guards were largely indifferent to us. After one difficult interrogation, I was left in the interrogation room for the night, tied in ropes. A gun guard, whom I had noticed before but had never spoken to, was working the night shift. A short time after the interrogators had left me to ponder my bad attitude for the evening, this guard entered the room and silently, without looking at me or smiling at me, loosened the ropes, and then he left me alone. A few minutes before his shift ended, he returned and tightened up the ropes. On Christmas Day, we were always treated to a better-than-usual dinner. We were also allowed to stand outside our cells for 5 minutes to exercise or to just look at the trees and sky. One Christmas, a few months after the gun guard had inexplicably come to my assistance during my long night in the interrogation room, I was standing in the dirt courtyard when I saw him approach me. He walked up and stood silently next to me. Again, he didn't smile or look at me. He just stared at the ground in front of us. After a few moments had passed, he rather nonchalantly used his sandaled foot to draw a cross in the dirt. We both stood wordlessly looking at the cross until after a minute or two, he rubbed it out and walked away. I saw my Good Samaritan often, after the Christmas when we venerated the cross together, but he never said a word to me or gave the slightest signal that he acknowledged my humanity. An Air Force major lived in the cell next to me at the plantation. Bob Craner and I were tireless communicators. We talked endlessly through our cups or by tap code on any subject that came to mind. Bob was a naturally taciturn fellow. He had a roommate for a time, but I was alone, and I needed to talk as much as possible with my neighbor to keep from lapsing into despair. So Bob kept up his end of our ceaseless conversation to get me through my years in solitary. Air Force pilots were allowed to fly only 100 combat missions in Vietnam. When Bob had completed his 100th mission, he requested and was denied another tour by his commanding officer. He went to Saigon to argue his case with the Air Force Command in Vietnam. After a long campaign, his superiors relented and granted him another tour. He was shot down on his 102nd mission. He never complained about his misfortune, nor regretted having prevailed on the Air Force to let him fly another combat tour. He joked when he told me about it, laughing when he remarked, "Well, I guess I got my wish." He was my dear friend, and for 2 years I was closer to him than I had ever been to another human being. Bob spoke for both of us when, months after we were released from prison, he described how completely we had relied on each other to preserve our humanity. McCain and I leaned on each other a great deal. We were separated by about 18 inches of brick. I didn't know what he looked like. We got to know each other more intimately, I'm sure, than I will ever know my wife. We opened up and talked about damn near everything besides our immediate problems, past life, and all the family things we would never have talked to anybody about. We derived a great deal of strength from this. A great deal of strength indeed. Bob Craner kept me alive. Without his strength, his wisdom, his humor, and his unselfish consideration, I doubt I would have survived solitary with my mind and my self-respect reasonably intact. Whenever I was plagued by doubts about my situation or my own conduct, I turned to the voice on the other side of my wall. And it was to Bob I went for guidance one June evening in 1968, after the Vietnamese had offered me my freedom. For months, I had received conspicuously lenient treatment. Sometime in the middle of June 1968, I was summoned to an interview with the CAT. His interpreter was an English-speaking officer we called the Rabbit, an experienced torturer who enjoyed his work. I had been brought to the large reception room in the big house, the room they often brought visiting peace delegations to for their clumsily staged propaganda displays. The room was furnished with upholstered chairs, a sofa, and a glass table supported by two decorative ceramic elephants. An inviting spread of tea, cookies, and cigarettes had been laid out on the table. After about 2 hours of circuitous conversation, the CAT asked me if I wanted to go home. I was astonished by the offer and didn't immediately know how to respond. The prospect of going home to my family was powerfully tempting, but I knew what the code of conduct instructed. The Vietnamese usually required prisoners who were released early to make some statement that indicated their gratitude or at least their desire to be released. As soon as I could, I raised Bob Craner and asked for his advice. Bob told me I should go home. He argued that the seriously injured should be excused from the code's restrictions on accepting amnesty and should take release if offered. He said I should go home, as my long-term survival in prison was in doubt. Bob had never observed my physical condition and had only reports from other prisoners and my own occasional references to the state of my health, upon which to base his judgment about my fitness. Yet this good man, who revered our code of conduct and who braved the worst adversity with dignity, offered me a rationale to go home. I wanted to say yes. I badly wanted to go home. I was tired and sick, and despite my bad attitude, I was often afraid. But I couldn't keep from my own counsel the knowledge of how my release would affect my father and my fellow prisoners. I knew what the Vietnamese hoped to gain from my release. Although I did not know it at the time, my father would shortly assume command of the war effort as Commander-in-Chief Pacific. The Vietnamese intended to hail his arrival with a propaganda spectacle as they released his son in a gesture of goodwill. I was to be enticed into accepting special treatment in the hope that it would shame the new enemy commander. Moreover, I knew that every prisoner the Vietnamese tried to break, those who had arrived before me and those who would come after me, would be taunted with the story of how an admiral's son had gone home early, a lucky beneficiary of America's class-conscious society. I knew that my release would add to the suffering of men who were already straining to keep faith with their country. I couldn't persuade myself to leave. Several days later, I went to tell the CAT I wouldn't accept his offer. I sat for some time in the same well-furnished room with the CAT and the Rabbit, exchanging pleasantries and helping myself to their cigarettes. CAT tried to convince me that I had permission from my commander-in-chief to return home, President Johnson has ordered you home. Show me the orders. President Johnson orders you. Show me the orders, and I'll believe you. He handed me a letter from Carol in which she expressed her regret that I had not been released earlier with Norris and the other two prisoners. It was the kind of thing you expect your wife to say. I didn't believe that Carol wanted me to dishonor myself, and the fact that the Vietnamese had kept her letter from me until now angered me, an emotion that usually serves to stiffen my resolve. A week later, I was summoned to a third interview, much weakened by dysentery, which had worsened since our last meeting. During these sessions, the cat had promised me that I would not be required to make any propaganda statements in return for my release. I had no doubt that he was lying. On the morning of the 4th of July, Soft Soap entered my cell and mentioned that he knew I had received a generous offer to go home. "You will have a nice family reunion, Mac Cain," he suggested. "Yes," I acknowledged, "but I can't accept it." A few hours later, I faced a solemn cat. That morning, the camp loudspeakers broadcast the news that three prisoners had been chosen for early release. The cat had summoned me to offer me one last chance to accept his offer. My final answer is no. In a fit of pique, the cat snapped the ink pen he had been holding between his hands. Ink splattered on a copy of the International Herald Tribune lying on the table, open to a column by Art Buchwald. He stood up, kicked over his chair, and spoke to me in English for the first time. "They taught you too well, Mac Cain. They taught you too well," he shouted as he abruptly left the room. Yes, they had. The rabbit and I sat there for a few moments staring at each other in silence before he angrily dismissed me. "Now it will be very bad for you, Mac Cain. Go back to your room." I did as instructed and awaited the moment when the rabbit's prediction would come true. That same day, my father assumed command of all U.S. forces in the Pacific. I wouldn't learn of my father's promotion for nearly a year, when two recently captured pilots were brought to the plantation. A few months after they arrived, one of them managed to get a one-sentence message to me. "Your father assumed Commander-in-Chief in the Pacific, July 4th, 1968. The days dragged on as I waited for the cat to make good on his threat. I knew a bad time lay ahead, and for almost 2 months, nothing happened. Three prisoners had been released in early August. Their departure had been delayed for several weeks, and I assumed the Vietnamese had neglected my punishment to avoid complicating the release. I assumed that the Vietnamese were worried that if word got out that I had been tortured for refusing to leave, the prisoners who had accepted release might change their minds. Then one evening in late August, several guards came and announced that the camp commander, the rough customer we called Slopehead, wanted to see me. They took me to a large room, a theater that had been used for Christmas services the year before. Speaking through an interpreter, Slopehead accused me of committing black crimes against the people. He told me the time had come for me to show gratitude to the Vietnamese people. I replied, "Fuck you." "Why do you treat your guards disrespectfully?" "Because they treat me like an animal." Hearing this, Slopehead gave an order, and the guards lit into me. Shouting and laughing, they bashed me around the room, slamming their fists into my face and body, kicking and stomping me when I fell. Lying on the floor bleeding, I heard Slopehead speak to the interpreter. "Are you ready to confess your crimes?" "No." With that, the guards hauled me up and set me on the stool. They cinched ropes around my biceps, anchored it behind my back, and then left the room. In the morning, three guards came in, removed the rope, and took me to an interrogation room where the deputy camp commander, a dull-witted man we called Frankenstein, for his bulging forehead and numerous facial warts, waited for me. When I refused his order to confess, I was dragged to the room behind my cell where sometime later Ernie Brace would be held. The room was empty of any furnishing save a waste bucket. The room didn't have a door, only a louvered window large enough to pass through. I was kept there for 4 days. At 2 to 3 hour intervals, the guards returned to administer beatings. One guard would hold me while the others pounded away. Most blows were directed at my shoulders, chest, and stomach. Occasionally, when I had fallen to the floor, they kicked me in the head. They cracked several of my ribs and broke a couple of teeth. My bad right leg was swollen and hurt the most of any of my injuries. Weakened by beatings and dysentery, and with my right leg again nearly useless, I found it almost impossible to stand. On the third night, I lay in my own blood and waste, so tired and hurt that I could not move. The prick came in with two other guards, lifted me to my feet, and gave me the worst beating I had yet experienced. At one point, he slammed his fist into my face and knocked me across the room toward the waste bucket. I fell on the bucket, hitting it with my left arm and breaking it again. They left me lying on the floor, moaning from the stabbing pain in my refractured arm. Despairing of any relief from pain and further torture and fearing the close approach of my moment of dishonor, I tried to take my life. I doubt I really intended to kill myself, but I couldn't fight anymore, and I remember deciding that the last thing I could do to make them believe I was still resisting, that I wouldn't break, was to attempt suicide. Obviously, it wasn't an ideal plan, but it struck me at the time as reasonable. Slowly, after several unsuccessful attempts, I managed to stand. With my right arm, I pushed my shirt through one of the upper shutters and back through a bottom shutter. As I looped it around my neck, the prick saw the shirt through the window. He pulled me off the bucket and beat me. Later, I made a second, even feebler attempt, but a guard saw me fumbling with the shutter, hauled me down, and beat me again. On the fourth day, I gave up. "I am a black criminal," the interrogator wrote, "and I have performed the deeds of an air pirate. I almost died, and the Vietnamese people saved my life. The doctors gave me an operation that I did not deserve." An interrogator had edited my last draft and decided to rewrite most of it himself. He then handed it to me and told me to copy it out in my own hand. I started to print it in block letters, and he ordered me to write it in script. He demanded that I add an admission that I had bombed a school. I refused, and we argued back and forth about the confession's contents for a long time before I gave in to his demand. Finally, they had me sign the document. They took me back to my room and let me sleep through the night. The next morning, they brought me back to the theater and ordered me to record my confession on tape. I refused and was beaten until I consented. I was returned to my cell and left alone for the next 2 weeks. They were the worst 2 weeks of my life. I couldn't rationalize away my confession. I was ashamed, I felt faithless, and couldn't control my despair. I shook as if my disgrace were a fever. I kept imagining that they would release my confession to embarrass my father. All my pride was lost, nothing could save me. No one would ever look upon me again with anything but pity or contempt. Bob Craner tried to reassure me that I had resisted all that I was expected to resist, but I couldn't shake it off. One night, I either heard or dreamed I heard myself confessing over the loudspeakers, thanking the Vietnamese for receiving medical treatment I did not deserve. Many guys broke at one time or another. I doubt anyone ever gets over it entirely. There's never enough time and distance between the past and the present to allow one to forget his shame. I'm recovered now from that period of intense despair, but I can summon up its feeling in an instant whenever I let myself remember the day. The following month, Averill Harriman, then serving as President Johnson's emissary to the fruitless peace negotiations in Paris with the North Vietnamese, sent the following cable to Secretary of State Dean Rusk. At last tea break, Lê Duc Tho attended, he mentioned that DRV had intended to release Admiral McCain's son as one of the three pilots freed recently, but he had refused. They came back at the end of 2 weeks for another statement. I didn't give it to them. I had recovered enough to resist. The next year and a half would be the hardest months of my captivity. The severe treatment of prisoners lasted until the end of 1969. During this period, we were beaten for communicating with one another, for declining to meet with visiting American peace delegations, for refusing to make statements and broadcasts, and for mouthing off to our guards. I had a hard time suppressing the urge to verbally assault my captors as they went about the business of humiliating me. Acts of defiance felt so good that I felt they more than compensated for their repercussions, and they helped me keep at bay the unsettling feelings of guilt and self-doubt that my confession had aroused. Whenever I emerged from the interrogation room after a few hours or a few days of punishment, I tried to make a show of my indifference to my circumstances. Whether I walked of my own accord or was dragged by guards back to my cell, I always shouted greetings to the prisoners whose cells I passed, smiled, and flashed a thumbs up. In the years since I came home, I have occasionally been embarrassed to hear some of my fellow POWs commend me for those attempts at good cheer. They believed they were intended to boost their spirits. In truth, they were mostly intended to boost my own. The arrogance I sometimes displayed to my captors contradicted the humility I felt around other prisoners who were routinely and severely tortured. Dick Stratton had suffered horribly under torture. He had huge infected scars on his arms from rope torture. His thumbnails had been torn off, and he had been burned with cigarettes. By such means, they had forced him to attend a press conference. When they ushered him into the room, Dick affected the vacant stare of a catatonic and bowed deeply in four directions towards his surprised captors, thereby signaling to the Americans who would see the broadcast that the POWs were obviously being tortured. In May 1969, two Air Force officers, John Dramisi and Ed Atterbury, who had been captured a few months before my shootdown, managed a daring escape from the zoo, the prison in the southwest of the city where conditions were awful. They were recaptured at dawn the next day. They were cruelly tortured for their courage. Ed Atterbury was beaten to death. But John, one of the toughest men I have ever known, survived. Those of us held at the plantation surmised that something had happened. Our room inspections became more frequent and more thorough. Our interrogations became considerably more intense. One of the plantation POWs had been severely tortured for information about suspected escape plans at the plantation, his tormentors refusing to believe his protestations that there were none. These developments, together with the general worsening of our conditions, alerted us that someone had probably attempted to escape. Instances of surpassing courage and defiance were commonplace in those worst days of captivity, and they made my own attempts at rebellion seem minor in comparison. To maintain our unity, prisoners relied heavily on the senior ranking officers to promulgate policies for the camps. The primary reason the Vietnamese worked so hard to disrupt our communications was to prevent any form of military unit cohesion from strengthening our resistance. Toward that end, they segregated senior officers from the rest of the prison population, making communication with them difficult, and they kept many of the most determined and inventive communicators in solitary confinement. Contact with senior officers is a very important element of an effective campaign of resistance, and we worked as hard to maintain communications with them as the guards worked to prevent them. We relied on senior officers for more than affirmations or interpretations of the code of conduct. Frequently, we needed little more than a word of encouragement from our commander to firm up our own resolve when we were preparing to endure the latest round of interrogations. Our senior officers always stressed to us the three essential keys to resistance, which we were to keep uppermost in our mind. They were faith in God, faith in country, and faith in your fellow prisoners. There were times in many a prisoner's existence when the Vietnamese came close to robbing his faith, when a prisoner felt abandoned, left to cling to faith in himself as his last strength, his last form of resistance. Certainly this had been my experience when I was broken in the fall of 1968. Ironically, for someone who had so long asserted his own individuality as his first and best defense against insults of any kind, I discovered that faith in myself proved to be the least formidable strength I possessed. Faith in myself was important and remains important to my self-esteem. But I discovered in prison that faith in myself alone, separate from other more important allegiances, was ultimately no match for the cruelty that human beings could devise when they were entirely unencumbered by respect for the God-given dignity of man. POWs often regard their prison experience as comparable to the trials of Job. Indeed, hungry, beaten, hurt, scared, and alone, human beings can begin to feel that they are removed from God's love, a vast distance separating them from their Creator. The anguish can lead to the awful despair that God has forsaken you. Once I was thrown into another cell after a long and difficult interrogation. I discovered scratched into one of the cell's walls the creed, "I believe in God, the Father Almighty." There, standing witness to God's presence in a remote, concealed place, recalled to my faith by a stronger, better man, I felt God's love and care more vividly than I would have felt it had I been safe among a pious congregation in the most magnificent cathedral. The Vietnamese also went to great lengths to sow doubts in our minds about our country and each other. They threatened us constantly that we would never again be free. They taunted us with insults, disparaged our loyalty to a country they claimed never asked about us, or made our return the subject of negotiations. We were abandoned, they insisted, by a country busy with a war that wasn't going well and too torn apart by widespread domestic turmoil to worry about a few forgotten pilots in Hanoi. In prison, I fell in love with my country. I had loved her before then, but like most young people, my affection was little more than a simple appreciation for the comforts and privileges that most Americans enjoyed and took for granted. It wasn't until I had lost America for a time that I realized how much I loved her. I loved what I missed most from my life at home, my family and friends, the sights and sounds of my country, the hustle and purposefulness of Americans. But though I longed for the things at home I cherished the most, I still shared the ideals of America. It was what freedom conferred on America that I loved the most, the distinction of being the last, best hope of humanity, the advocate for all who believed in the rights of man. When my interrogators played tapes to me of other POWs confessing to war crimes, expressing their gratitude for lenient treatment, or denouncing our government, I did not silently censure my comrades. I knew that they had made those statements under the most extreme duress, and I told the Vietnamese so. "No, they are their true feelings," the interrogator would rebut, "and you should not be ashamed to state your true feelings. We will not tell anyone if you do. No one would know." "I would know. I would know," I responded. We were told to have faith in God, country, and one another. Most of us did. A few men lost their religion in prison or had never been very devout. A few men were not moved by appeals to patriotism or to written codes of conduct. Almost all of us were committed to one another. My first concern was not that I might fail God and country, although I certainly hoped that I would not. I was afraid to fail my friends. This is the truth of war, of honor and courage, that my father and grandfather had passed on to me. But before my war, I thought glory was the object of war, and all glory was self-glory. No more. For I've learned the truth. There are greater pursuits than self-seeking. Glory is not a conceit. It is not a decoration for valor. It is not a prize for being the most clever, the strongest, or the boldest. Glory belongs to the act of being constant to something greater than yourself, to a cause, to your principles, to the people on whom you rely, and who rely on you in return. No misfortune, no injury, no humiliation can destroy it. This is the faith that my commanders affirmed, that my brothers in arms encouraged my allegiance to. It was a faith I had unknowingly embraced at the Naval Academy. It was my father's and grandfather's faith. A filthy, crippled, broken man, all I had left of my dignity was the faith of my fathers. It was enough. As my days in captivity lengthened, the man whose example had led me to Vietnam stood at the summit of his long naval career. After his appointment as Sinh Pac was announced, my father assumed command of the Pacific in the last year of the Johnson administration and held it until July 1972, the last year of Richard Nixon's first term. My wife, mother, sister, and brother attended his change of command ceremony, which, at his request, was held aboard the Oriskany, the carrier I was flying off the day I was shot down. Henry Kissinger once told me that whenever he suspected President Nixon's resolve to make difficult decisions about the war was wavering, he arranged for my father to brief the president. My father wasn't much of a believer in fighting wars by half measures. For the rest of his life, he believed that had he been allowed to wage total war against the enemy, fully employing strategic air power, mining Vietnamese ports early on, and launching large-scale offensives in the North, he could have brought the war to a successful conclusion in months, if not weeks. He was exaggerating, I'm sure, to make a point. He recalled with resentment Washington's refusal to accede to the military's plans for a major offensive to be launched from the old imperial capital, Hue. The plan called for an amphibious assault on Hue to spearhead a drive around the flanks of the North Vietnamese army and across the country to the border, cutting the enemy's supply lines from the north. Permission for this operation was refused, he lamented, because Washington was afraid that the Red Chinese might then enter the war. It was a ridiculous conclusion based on no evidence, just fear and anxiety. Even before he assumed command in the Pacific, when he was still a Navy chief in Europe, he had prepared and delivered a briefing to the Joint Chiefs of Staff on the feasibility and necessity of mining the port of Haiphong. Like any other capable military strategist, he knew that the support the Vietnamese and the Viet Cong received from the Soviet Union and China was critical to their ability to simply outlast us. Without the massive support of their allies, they would fail. My father doubted either country would be provoked to the point of war if we rightly decided to disrupt their efforts to aid our enemy, efforts which, after all, resulted in the deaths of many thousands of Americans. Indeed, he interpreted Soviet and Chinese actions as a far more reckless provocation of a great power than any response on our part was likely to be. Like the men who flew missions to the north, he knew the enemy's resolve was greatly strengthened by the material assistance their allies provided them, and he wanted to do something about it. Most of the arms and supplies used by North Vietnam's armies entered the country through the port of Haiphong. Thanks to the strategic foresight of Admiral Moore, the Navy was well prepared to conduct mining operations in the enemy's ports. As early as 1966, military commanders began urging Washington to approve a mining operation, but they could not overcome Defense Secretary McNamara's and President Johnson's apprehension that the action entailed too great a risk of a wider war. When the North Vietnamese launched a major offensive in December 1971, at a time when U.S. forces in Vietnam had been reduced to 69,000 men, President Nixon finally directed my father to mine Haiphong and other northern ports immediately. The administration authorized the immediate use of B-52 bombers for the first time to strike North Vietnamese targets. The following May, the administration ordered my father to commence mining operations in North Vietnamese harbors. The war's escalation, so long anticipated as the unavoidable result of mining the harbors, did not occur. The administration's opening to China and its policy of détente with the Soviets were by this time well established and contributed significantly to the response of the Soviets and the Chinese to the mining of their clients' harbors. Their reaction to what was once feared as a casus belli was remarkably muted. The reaction in both the higher and lower reaches of the United States military was relief. The men charged with fighting the war believed that for the first time a rational policy to undercut the enemy's critical lifeline was in effect. Thus, they and their civilian bosses reasoned, the war's end would be hastened. The reaction among the Americans held as prisoners in Hanoi, who learned of the actions from new arrivals to our ranks, was unanimous approval.